Okay, the House Committee on Education will come to order. Will come to Oregon. I think we all woke up in Oregon today. At least I did. Welcome to Monday at the Capitol. Today we are doing an informational meeting on the enrollment and retention of foster youth in educational opportunities. This is an idea that was brought to me by Bill Thelmer and Rita Cavan, who's the president of Lynn Benton Community College. This is an issue that is very close to President Cavan's heart, and she is very concerned about making sure that all students have opportunities to succeed and to pursue a future that brings them economic independence. So I'm really looking forward to hearing from everyone today. Before we call up our first witnesses, one of the things that's important here is to turn off your cell phones. The testimony will be interesting enough that you will want to be cut off from the whole rest of the world. You're not even going to care what's going on anyplace else. So please turn them all the way off, not even on vibrate, because it interferes with the sound system. And with that, Bill Thelmer, please. And Mark McKechnie, who are not together, but that way you're not lonely.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, everyone, for hearing us today. We sure appreciate it. I'm going to be pretty brief and kind of set up the day and what everybody is going to look forward to today.
And this is a really big. Bill, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm Bill Thelmer. I'm the Vice President, Student Services and Government Relations at Lynn Benton Community College. And so, how this came to us, we have over 300 applicants to Lynn Benton Community College. On your financial aid form, there's a place you can check if you are foster youth. Of the 300, only 150 actually enrolled in the institution for a variety of reasons. One of the things that we found out of those that applied to our institution, the average age of our foster youth is 35 years old. So that's a disturbing kind of flag that's sent up with us. It talked about there's a whole group that's kind of meandering and wandering without any help as they come out of the emancipation stage into their own, and so we're trying to work on ways to connect them with the right information, the right people, to get them engaged at an earlier age. I have four students with me that actually are going to bring you a myriad of how they go through the system and things that they need, put a real face on what we're doing, and I brought a couple of people in the state system and how we're all going to work together. This is a good program about working together and making sure the resources are used properly, and it all boils down to helping students, and that's what our whole goal is about. So I thank you for your time today, and I hope you look forward to hearing a bunch of nice people today. Thank you.
Thank you. Mark.
Good morning, Chair Gelzer and members of the committee. My name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. We are a nonprofit law and advocacy organization that represents about 1,800 children and youth each year, 80% of them in the foster care system. I'm here today to give some, I think, background on some of the previous efforts that have been made to improve access to college for foster youth exiting foster care. As a bit of background, we worked on a bill that was passed by the 2001 legislature that created a former foster child scholarship fund. It allowed youth who had been in foster care between the ages of 16 and 21 for at least 12 months to be able to get tuition support from the Student Assistance Commission, equivalent up to 4 years tuition at a state university. The appropriation was made for that scholarship fund in the 2001 biennium. Some money was cut at the very end of the biennium during the recession, and it has not been funded again since then. I can offer more of the context and more of the background than some of the other presenters, so that's what I'm going to focus on rather than some of the details, but I have provided some of the current costs and current aid that's available for students through Oregon Student Assistance Commission and federal grants today. I think consistent with the beginning of the presentation, only about a third or just over a third of foster youth exiting foster care graduate from high school on time. And less than 3%, according to the research we have available, earn a college degree by the age of 25. So the odds are 97-3 against youth exiting foster care earning a college degree by the age of 25. And I think that's why you hear that some students are matriculating much later, well beyond their 20s. There are several reasons that conspire against foster youth following the more usual course from high school to college. As you may know, foster youth often leave home or whatever home that they had as wards of the state around the age of 18 after they graduate from high school. Some stay later if they're still in school, but generally, unlike many children and youth, they are on their own at the age of 18, don't necessarily have that base to return to, the system of both emotional and financial support to return to that many of us enjoyed well beyond the age of 18, and to the frustration of the parents, some enjoy into their 20s, 30s, maybe even 40s. But specifically, what we've seen among the youth that we represent, one, a lack of information starting early on about what do you do to get to college? What do you need to do? What do you need to prepare in high school? What are the forms you need to fill out? What are the deadlines? How do you apply to college? And the lack of adults in their lives who can help fill in some of those gaps. Life in foster care can be somewhat chaotic, and it can be difficult to meet the hard and fast deadlines for college applications and financial aid applications, and youth can miss out on aid that they're entitled to, either in part or in whole, if they miss those important deadlines. Is another issue that we've identified is that if youth are not college ready when they go to community college or four-year college, if they don't have the reading skills, the math skills, the writing skills, the study skills, they need to pay to take classes that will bring their skills up to college level. And therefore using the limited financial aid that's available to them to catch up to their peers, and may exhaust that aid before they graduate. Family remains important, and I'm sure many of us called home in a panic as we needed that last $50 to get us through the month, or went home to do our laundry because we didn't have money to pay the laundromat, or just went home to enjoy a home-cooked meal rather than paying for food on campus, and that is not an option to many former foster youth. So very small amounts of money make a very big difference into whether former foster youth can make ends meet on their own as college students. I won't go over this in detail, but basically the research says that putting off college entry or going part-time or working full-time, having to work full-time to make it through college, are all barriers that reduce the chances that a student will finish and earn a degree. And those are all significant concerns for former foster youth. The research also shows that relatively modest financial support, additional financial support above what's available, can make a significant difference in reducing some of those barriers and dramatically increasing the chances that students will persist and finish. And finally, what I will say is that generally why this matters is we're trying to break cycles that run in families where many foster youth will be the first in their family to graduate from college if they're able to do so. And by doing so, they will have many more opportunities and be able to live different lives than often the generations that preceded them in their families, and make it less likely that they will be coming back to the state either by choice or because the state decides to intervene in their lives as parents, and make it more likely that they will be self-sufficient and successful and no longer be involved with DHS or other state services as adults. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? President Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. This is for Mr. McKechnie. In discussing the foster children in working and trying to go to school, one of the questions that occurred to me is, having had a number of my staff going to school and working full-time, it depends upon where they're working and the attitude of the work towards their school. Is that a valid observation on my part?
Chair Gelser, Representative Van Ortman, yes, obviously there are many variables. Not all of these factors apply for all youth leaving foster care. Some are fortunate to find understanding employers who, you know, may allow them to study at work or be flexible around their class schedule, things like that. But I think if you look at a population of students, what the research shows is that needing to work full-time or only being able to attend school part-time or delaying entry are all things that reduce the chances of completing a degree in general.
Thank you.
You talked about the importance of preparation to be ready to go for to college and the challenges that foster youth face. Do you have a sense of the average number of times a foster youth in Oregon will change schools during their K through 12 career? And how often that would be mid-year?
Chair Gelser, the data that I'm most familiar with is a little bit dated at this point from 2005. They looked retrospectively at youth both in Washington and Oregon who had left foster care, and on average, this was the Casey Family Study, on average they changed foster homes 1.4 times a year, and nearly two-thirds had attended seven different schools, and 30% had attended 10 or more schools. I changed more schools more frequently than some. I went to five schools, and still the vast majority of foster youth attended more than that. And as you said, that when foster youth or foster children change schools, it's less likely to be that planned transition where the family bought a new house or a new job, moved during the summer, get started in a new school. It can be very sudden and abrupt in the middle of the school year. Fortunately, the legislature took steps in 2005 to try to address that problem. It was House Bill 3075, which amended the ORS 339-133, the enrollment statute, and allows the juvenile court to make a finding that it's in the child's best interest to stay in the same school even when they enter foster care or move between foster homes. Certainly that has benefited hundreds of children. It's hard to say in the big scheme of things whether that has substantially changed the pattern that the Casey Family Foundation found in 2005.
Thank you. Are there other questions for this panel? Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, it seems to me that we clearly need to enhance the resources that we have available for foster youth. We also need to really enhance the outreach that we make to get youth just aware of their options and what kind of financial options are available, and just how their lives can be much better through the investment of education. So I'm wondering, looking at that, what exactly does the Juvenile Rights Project do along those lines to do outreach to students, potential students, and to help draw them into the system?
Chair Gelser, Representative Dembro. Given that our role is in the lives of many foster youth is their attorney, I think we nonetheless do a significant amount of encouraging students to think about college. We work directly with school districts on behalf of our clients who are struggling through a program of ours called SchoolWorks to help make sure that they're not falling too far behind academically. So making sure that they're if they're in the eighth grade, they're not reading at a first grade level, or making sure that the supports get in place to help correct that if that's the case. Getting them in line and ready to start independent living services as soon as they become eligible, so that they start some of those independent living skills, including looking at higher education. And our independent living programs are usually the vehicle through which foster youth get access to the federal CHAFE programs, which include education and training vouchers. So even if college isn't the plan, getting vocational training or other post-secondary training or education, and making a plan to do that. Frankly, one of the motivations that we had for creating the scholarship in 2001 was to send a message to foster youth that you have this support to look forward to in the future, even if you're only in middle school now. If you stay in school and study and apply yourself, the state is going to make it possible for you to go to college. Obviously, I think we could send a stronger message along those lines now, but there are a number of things that we do, and certainly more that can be done. I also think an area that we don't get into is mentoring for those youth who need support, and knowing how to be in school, stay in school, develop study skills, develop academic skills, all those things. Thank you.
Any further questions?
And Chair Gelzer, thank you. I don't know if this question is appropriate for these two gentlemen, but somewhere in this discussion, I'd really like to hear about the health care needs of foster children, especially as they're in that emancipation period, and whether they know what opportunities they have. I've dealt with a number of students that are teen parents, what the WIC program has to offer. I don't know how they access that information and what kind of supports are there for the youth.
Chair Gelser, Representative Comp, I have some information that touches on your question, I think, in terms of foster youth are on the Oregon Health Plan as long as they're in foster care, and then the state allows emancipating foster youth to apply to remain on the Oregon Health Plan to continue their access to health care, even during those times when the list has been, or the applications have been closed to other adults. That has been possible, and basically they can stay eligible under the child criteria through age 19, but then past that they have to meet the eligibility criteria as an adult. There is an option under Medicaid that allows states to buy in and extend Oregon Medicaid coverage, which is the Oregon Health Plan here, through age 21 for former foster youth, and that is not an option that Oregon has taken advantage of.
Thank you. That's very helpful, because those transition years, yeah, and if I'd love to get more information about how we can make that possible.
Can follow up with that a little later. Representative Huffman?
Chair Gelser, I don't know how.
I'm sorry. Can you speak into your microphone, because you're getting feedback on yours particularly, and it's really, my wife would say I can't hear it, but it's really annoying me. So if
that's why I was trying to kind of whisper.
But he's here.
Oh, you're here. Oh, so is it like a testing, 1, 2, 3 kind of thing? Are we good now? All right.
Yeah.
So I don't have to whisper anymore?
Thanks, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Representative Huffman.
We can hear you now, Chair Gelser.
Thank you.
I don't know how much you wanted to pursue it here, but Kevin is in the audience from Foster Parenting DHS and could probably answer Representative Comp's questions articulately.
And I think because we have a long panel of people that are going to talk about the education needs today, we can. Is it okay to loop back with that, Representative Comp?
Oh, that's fine. I just know that you're not going to educate unless you're healthy.
Excellent point. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I actually, when I asked you that question, Mark, I actually should have also directed it to Bill, because I'm wondering what the colleges are doing in terms of outreach to foster youth, and as well as support once they have chosen to enroll.
Well, part of that, Representative Gelser and Representative Dimbrough, is that the high schools are very protective of this group, and they tend not to self-disclose. If we didn't have this checkbox on the FAFSA form, the financial aid form, we wouldn't be able to identify this particular group. It's not like you can put a big sign out in your student services area that says, foster youth program, come here and see us, because it's not the self-disclosure, there's a tough piece. We have good relationships with our high schools, and so they help us to kind of know which students are where, and we kind of educate our financial aid people and some of our counselors to make sure they understand what the CHAFE Act is, what the ETV is, some of those terms that the foster youth know. Mm-hmm. So right now, I think we're very lax about what we need to do. We don't know where to step. So we're trying to really collaborate with most of the groups and some of the people I brought with us to talk about how we can work together, still maintain confidentiality, but serve the group that so badly needs the services. So right now, I would say we're not doing a great job at all. We need to do a much better job in some kind of a uniform way in getting the DHS, the OSAC group, and our group together to talk about how we can create a pathway for them.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up, and I'm also thinking of those students who have perhaps stopped out for a year or two, you know, to draw them back into education.
And that goes back to the workforce that Representative Van Orme is talking about. Some of them have to work so much that they can only take one class at a time. So it really elongates their completion for how long. They spend 6 to 7 years mm-hmm. just completing the two-year degree.
Thank you. Representative Maurer.
One quick question, and this is for both of you. How important is permanency in this conversation of enrollment into community college or higher education?
Chair Gelser, Representative Maurer. On the second page of my written testimony, under delays can become forever, where the research says that living without financial support from one's family is a major risk factor for not persisting and completing higher education. So obviously, if a child has found a forever family while they're in foster care and they're going to continue and provide emotional and the financial support that they're able well beyond the age of 18, that can make all the difference.
I would echo his comments, Representative Maurer, that the consistency that they lack in most of foster youth are probably 80% of why they don't persist at the community college. There's no help or support group to get them over a bump or something that happens. Say financial aid comes up and they're all of a sudden out of the loop. There's nobody there to help them to understand what are my next steps, what else is out there, how do I cope with this. The permanency of a family certainly gives them that support group to say, here's where you need to go, here's another resource you get to. So the more they hop around and get shoved around, the less chance they have of finishing. We have data on that one for sure, but that's the constancy, is all the importance is us keeping them there in the college.
Any further questions for this panel? Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Next, we have Vicki Merkel and Peggy Cooksey. Welcome, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Vicki Merkel, and I'm the Scholarship and Access Programs Director at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. And I have with me at the table also Peggy Cooksey, who is the Scholarship Portfolio Coordinator for the CHAFE Grant, and she works at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission also. The committee assistant is handing out some materials prepared by the commission, and one is the white paper that we presented or wrote about a year ago based on the programs that we have administered for this population since 2001, as you heard, when legislation and funding were passed, and then later through the federal CHAFE grant. We've been the administrators of that grant as well as some other services. So I leave that white paper with you. We also have a handout that will be going over regarding financial aid opportunities for students and a publication that OSAC has, or the commission has provided with funding from the federal Chaffee grant for former foster youth. I'll try not to repeat the testimony that you've already heard, but I think it's important enough to just say it one more time that foster youth have hopes and dreams of attending colleges just like other young people. But you heard the statistics. They have dismal participation rates and even more dismal actual completion rates for colleges. One of the things that we know is that one of the best indicators of going to college is if you had a parent who went to college. Former foster parents in a national survey of child and adolescent well-being in 2003 showed that 56% of foster parents had a high school diploma or less. So our fallback, you know, these students don't have parents in their lives, our fallback of the foster parents has a large gap in it as far as someone who can help them. At the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, we have many programs that deal with access issues for students. And we talk about underrepresented students, those of low socioeconomic status, students of ethnicities who are underserved in post-secondary education, and those who are first in their family. When I started this work 10 years ago, and I'm formerly from a social services background, I wasn't really aware of this population, and I think that still happens. It's almost a subset within underrepresented students are the former foster youth. Their unique needs often, as you heard, go unrecognized on campuses. I think you'll hear from the foster youth themselves, but there are situations in our lives where sometimes we don't want to be different from other people, especially maybe perhaps when we're teenagers. So we're not coming forward with the information about what our special needs are, and that's why I think it's so important for policymakers and others to deal with some of these special concerns. The Department of Human Services, as you heard, currently administers the federal Chaffee Education and Training Grant, and they contract with the Commission for several services. One is our Aspire program, which is a mentoring program that works with students. And we hold workshops for former foster youth and current foster parents around the state every fall to talk to them specifically about admissions and financial aid. And then we provide this little pocket publication, and this is specifically made for foster youth. It's designed to go in a backpack or a purse. It has important college dates on it. If you, as you heard, you may be a student who's moving around a lot, you may not have that, you know, platinum standard of a desk at home and all your college access materials alphabetized by school admissions and all the financial aid you've applied for. It's a little harder to keep up with that if you're on the move. So we created this pocket planner for students. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission and DHS started a conversation a year ago, which led to the white paper. We started a work group and said, what else can we do for students? Now, we're thinking, frankly, mostly of students as they come out of high school. You know, the Chaffee grant works with students up to age 24, so it's been wonderful to hear Mr. Tolliner from Lynn Benton talk about older students as well. But we found four focus areas where we think additional assistance is needed. And the first is to increase the visibility of the issue. Sharing information about the issues that former foster youth face as they leave the foster care system and choose options for their future is really important. I'd like to make a side comment about the health care issue. I've heard foster youth speak, and yes, they do have access to and a priority for health care, continuing health care, but they're sort of on their own to figure that out and sign up.
Exactly.
And that worries me. It worries me as a program director. It worries me as a citizen of Oregon. It worries me as a mom to potentially leave these youth without health care. We did a survey with the Department of Human Services, and one of the issues that came forward from that survey is the impact of having no health care when you're a student. You know, maybe you'd like to play intramural sports or take PE, but if you don't have health care, you may make other choices because you can't afford to be injured. I really appreciate the ongoing dialogue today, and I think it needs to continue. I know those of us on our work group have made a commitment commitment the last year to talk about this issue wherever we are. So if you've been at a meeting with me anywhere, I'll have been talking about former foster youth no matter what the topic. So thank you today for the opportunity to come. The second focus area was an increase in financial aid. Now, we recognize that the Oregon Opportunity Grant shared responsibility model is helping, and all of us appreciate Governor Kulongowski in the last legislative session for making that increase in need-based aid. And I'd like to turn this segment over to Peggy Cooksey to talk about the financial impact for financial aid impact for former foster youth.
Chair Geltzer and committee, thank you for having us today. I think what I'm going to do is start a little bit with giving you some information about the Chafee Education and Training Grant and then work our way back to the whole larger picture of financial aid. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission and the Department of Human Services, as Ms. Merkel has stated, we have an agreement to work together on this federally funded program. And over on the green sheet that is part of your packet, there's just some basic information about the eligibility that the student must have been in foster care for a minimum of 180 days after their 14th birthday, amongst other criteria to be eligible. And over the approximately 6-year period that this program has been in effect in this agreement, as you can see, the numbers of awards from 2003-04 to this current academic year has risen dramatically. Part of the reason for that increase has been that there's more information available. The Department of Human Services, the Independent Living Program, and the Oregon Student Assistance Commission tries to make the information available that this is a program that the former foster youth can apply for. In addition, what is increasing the number of awardees, is that we have made changes at the Oregon Student Assistance Commission to make it more accessible. We have changed our application because we feel that if the student qualifies for it, it is a grant. It's not a competitive scholarship. If they've been in the foster care and met the eligibility, it is a grant. So we have broken it away from our other scholarship application to make it a simpler application to complete. We've made an electronic application available so that the student can go in online, fill it out, and submit it, and they're done. And we have also worked in cooperation with the Department of Human Services to set up an online portal so that the Independent Living Program staff can go right into our portal and see who's applied and instantly determine that they are eligible. I get that information on a daily basis when they've determined somebody's eligibility, and then I in turn send that out to the schools that are participants in the Oregon Opportunity Grant in another portal. Continuing with the process, then the schools will look at that portal and calculate the actual award amount based on their cost of attendance. So we have streamlined the process to make it simpler for the student to apply, to make it faster for DHS to determine eligibility rather than passing forms back and forth, and for the school to help us determine their award amounts. Well, as simple as it might seem to get all of this done, in the meantime, the student is seeking other financial aid. If their FAFSA, they file their FAFSA, they maybe get a Pell Grant, probably get due because they are low income, get the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and get the Chafee. This brings us back to this whole package. When you look at page 7 of the white paper, we have a section about the gaps that the students are facing when they are in school. If a student is a community college student, even with full funding for Pell, Opportunity Grant, and Chafee, they're still looking at almost a $3,000 gap. And it only goes up from there if they are an Oregon University student or they have chosen to attend a not-for-profit independent college in the state of Oregon. That's another area of concern, those gaps. Yes, they can get student loans to cover those gaps, but when they are faced with how they're going to get through the week to buy food, to if they are living, going to a community college and commuting back and forth to pay for their commuting costs and so on, and those issues become so overwhelming that they end up not being able to complete their program, they're loaded with debt and no education or a partial education. And so that is a concern to those of us who work with the program. And so a lot of it goes back to, again, the information that's out there and having a source to help those students figure out, how do I handle these crises? And they do not have the family to go back to. They've aged out most of the time from the independent living program, and they're on their own without an advocate to speak for them. And now I will turn this back to Vicki.
Just to simply reiterate what Peggy's point was, and certainly we believe students have a responsibility, a shared responsibility in their education, but the particular needs and barriers that these students have already faced and the lack of backup systems could very well leave them worse off than when they started in education if they are not fully able to participate and complete. They could be working a minimum wage job and still having to pay student loan debt, and that's a very scary thought. The third and fourth focus areas that our work group describe in the white paper is to create an information bridge between the K-12 and post-secondary education system and to increase college retention and completion. Currently, the commission is a sub-grantee of the Oregon University System's Gear Up grant, and we plan to start a new component to our Aspire Outreach and Mentoring program next fall called Electronic Mentoring. This is a program that is a half-time position currently in the governor's recommended budget and funded from other funds from this Gear Up grant. I think this particular population is one that would fit well with electronic mentoring. We could have a student at an Aspire High School who has a terrific mentor, but then if they move, that plan falls all to pieces. They're not able to meet one-on-one on school premises with staff present, as is required by the Aspire program. Our electronic mentoring system, you would allow the mentor to follow the student no matter where they went. In case you're wondering, the emails would go through a secured site. We wouldn't be emailing, you know, hotgirl@yahoo.com. It would have security systems in place. So that's one way that the commission is looking to expand this information bridge. We currently also at the commission, in partnership with the Department of Human Services, provide face-to-face training for foster youth and foster families every fall on admissions and financial aid information. We think that we've learned a lot about the particular difficulties that former foster youth face, and are suggesting that one of the ways we can reach out and help these students transfer to campuses is to identify and train one or more staff on each Oregon campus, or start with a small group of pilot programs. As Mr. Tolomer said, it's not the population that you want to put a sign on the door that says former foster youth come here, but if we had people who were trained on the special issues, barriers, problems of former foster youth, and our network provided that information to students as they entered, they would have a go-to person on campus. It could be someone from a financial aid office, campus counseling and advising departments, resident life, student services, tutoring, etc. There could be, it doesn't always have to be necessarily one type of campus person. And the training could be low cost, and again, recognizing, you know, the economy and the financial situation, we're trying to brainstorm ways that have minimal cost. Training could be done, we're experimenting with webinar-based trainings where you can be at home in your slippers and log on and attend a training session. Just in closing, I just want to say that the partnership of the Department of Human Services and the Commission have done much to enable foster youth and former foster youth. However, getting to college is only half the battle. We want to work with all of the partners in succeeding, helping students succeed and persist, and we're committed to participating in any way that's helpful. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this issue, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you both very much. Are there questions? All right. Thank you very much. Our next two are Pamela Butler from Children First for Oregon and Emily Ryman from Independent Living Skills.
Good I'm Michelle Gelser, member of the committee. Thanks for having me here today. My name is Pamela Butler. I'm an employee of a nonprofit in Portland, Children First for Oregon. I'm also representing the Oregon Foster Youth Connection, a project of my organization, but I'm also a former foster youth after 11 years in the foster care system and aging out. And I've prepared a statement today. I apologize for reading it. For many young people, going to college is part of life. It's a time of stretching your wings, discovering who you are, having a newfound freedom, and having the time of your life. Most college-bound students enter this time of freedom with the knowledge that when difficulties arise, they can depend on their families to navigate them over those obstacles. But that's not the reality for many foster youth. You leave the foster care system at 18 or 19, only to find that when you need someone watching out for you back, there's nobody there. This doesn't ensure your failure, because many have survived higher education without any support, but it certainly sets you up to fail, to become another statistic. As you heard, less than 2% foster youth who enter higher education actually graduate. Many families face barriers these days to higher education because of the high costs, but there are many barriers, as you've heard, specific to foster youth, and they need to be understood and realized by the education system. For one, who helps you navigate the complexities of financial aid? Who helps you understand how to file your taxes? I still don't know how. Every student I knew had their parents do it for them. When I asked them for help, they didn't have any clue to help me. They never had to worry about renewing their FAFSA, applying for and retaining scholarships, or finding and obtaining health care. I've always been a very resourceful person, and those obstacles were huge. It never occurred to me that I would get school costs covered by scholarships that most people think is the greatest barrier, and then get kicked out of the dorms for all the holiday breaks. I ended up couch surfing on friends, former foster homes, couches, all through Christmas, spring breaks, just to have a place to sleep. But what if you don't have those people to fall back on? What if you don't have connections because you moved to so many foster homes and you don't even have friends because you launched into school from a city you never knew, foster parents who just wanted you out the door at 18? The cost, if you want to stay over vacations at college, it's pretty expensive. It adds cost. You don't get to stay there for free. You have to pay additional housing for board, and you have no access to food. You have to take a bus to a grocery store and buy food that you don't have to cook, because a lot of campuses don't have kitchens. That extra cost for foster youth, barely scraping by on a budget, could be the thing that breaks camel's back. With their best intentions, foster parents may send you off to college with a pat on the back. You're in college. They've done their job. But then who do you count on when you hate your roommate, you're in an abusive relationship, you have enormous issues relating to any of the kids on campus, and you've been having insomnia for weeks? You can't concentrate, your classes are slipping, you can't go to your lectures, you lie in bed all day. Who calls you to make sure that you're okay? When you've come from foster care, everyone thinks somebody else is taking care of it. For those of us aging out, it's beyond an issue of money, although that is a major barrier for most, but it's about having someone there who knows where you are, what you're doing, and is a resource when you've lost your way. I have to say that I am the luckiest girl in the world, because when I hit rock bottom, wanted to give up, and didn't think I was worth the air I breathed, I got a phone call. It was Tina Rahim from the Orphan Foundation of America, a scholarship I received through applying through OSAC. It's for current and former foster youth only. I had a scholarship with them and was required to keep in touch with the director weekly. She called because I hadn't replied in weeks. She also told me that not only was she worried, but my online mentor was worried as well. That was two people, not just one. I had two worried about me. The online mentor program is someone you keep in touch with through a separate portal. You keep in touch with them weekly. It's a requirement of your scholarship funding through them. And the person is meant to be a resource for, all those questions you have about financial aid. It has to be someone who's gone through college, so they know the ropes and they can kind of help you along. They can give you tips for how to apply for jobs, how to do interviews. They'll read your essays if you're scrambling at the last minute. They're They could be across the country. Mine was actually back in Virginia, and she was amazing and wonderful. We didn't have any phone contact. It was just through this portal, and there were times when she was the only email I got. the Orphan Foundation doesn't just hand you a tuition check and expect your life to be changed after you've come out of the system. They know that it's the little things that makes life great, a care package, a personal letter, regular emails, a birthday card, and even homemade chocolate chip cookies to kick off the term. No joke. They send them from across the country. They can connect you with a successful adult who keeps track of you as well. And they're often able to find resources on your campus from where they are that you never knew existed and wouldn't be nearly impossible to find as a student wandering around. There are a million things that I could say would have increased my well-being during college. When I say well-being, because after going through the system, you have to realize that it's not just about money and it's not just about getting into college, but there's a holistic view that you need to look at. This is a group of people who their family, when they get out, if they have a biological family, is often has never gone to college. They didn't even graduate from high school. They're not a resource. You often have foster parents who didn't go to college either. So if you're the one who wants to make this transition and you don't have anyone to turn to, and it's more about being a stable, healthy, happy, and successful individual, and that requires a lot more than just cash assistance. You can't have one without the other. But in these times, with the way things are, I'd like to leave you with just three things that might just be the hand up that a young person needs to make it through, and there's not a lot of costs associated with them. Well, maybe the first one. So one would be, OSAC mentioned this, having a resource, a person at some level somewhere who knows the barriers to going to higher education as a foster youth, who knows some of the loopholes, some of the little plugs that they can get you connected into your community. And as you leave CARE, it's a number you get handed, especially, well, if you're going into higher education, your caseworker can hand you it, this card, call this person, they will help you. That would be huge, and I had that resource through a scholarship program on the other side of the country, and it was my lifesaver many, many, many times. Second thing would be a university system that is informed and more proactively supporting foster youth going into higher education. And it sounds like we've got some really great supporters who are ready to make that step, and so I hope that we can all work together and do it. Thirdly, the big elephant in the room is healthcare. I am a strong proponent of supporting kids coming out of foster care with health care until they're 21. All the kids I knew at school had it until they got out of college. Even if it took them 10 years to finish, they had their parents' health care. And that was a huge barrier for me. I actually didn't have health care leaving foster care. There is an option that you can extend it, but you have to apply before you leave the system. And if you've had 12 caseworkers in the last year, you're in care, maybe they slip up and don't tell you that you have this option. So you leave, and once they close your case, you are not able to apply. That would be my top three suggestions. But thanks for giving me this opportunity to testify to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you have questions?
Representative Mao?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a similar question. Do you have a permanent relationship in the terms in foster care world of permanency?
I had a mom of a friend of mine who became my permanent connection, and actually took me my last year of high school, emergency certified, to be my foster parent. That's probably the only one.
And so you don't have a relationship now with that person?
Yes.
It's still continuing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm not going to follow up.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Thank you so much. Emily.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to be here this afternoon. I'm Emily Ryman. I'm the supervisor for the Looking Glass Independent Living Program in Lane County. The Independent Living Program is run on a contract basis by county, so Looking Glass is who has it in Lane. It's run by different organizations around the state. And I actually was going to launch directly into sort of college barriers, but would it be helpful for you to have a little bit of background about the Independent Living Program? How familiar is everybody with that topic? Okay, I'll give just the brief background if that works. Independent Living is a federally funded program for youth aging out of foster care. Youth qualify as soon as they've been in foster care for 180 days after their 14th birthday. So theoretically, at roughly 14 and a half, they can begin working with us. In Lane County, unfortunately, we have slots for 80 youth, and we currently have a waiting list of about 44. So we take them generally in age order, which means that most of the 14, 15, and even an awful lot of the 16-year-olds sit on our waiting list, and they don't actually get services through ILP. It's much more typical for us to begin opening youth when they're 16 and a half, 17. We try to get them as soon as they're juniors in high school, but that doesn't even always work out for us. So it means that many of the youth that are coming to us are well through their high school career, and we're just for the first time asking them what their goals are for college. In ILP, we don't just concentrate on college. We actually concentrate on a long list of skills and resources that youth need to be able to live as adults. That includes college, it also includes housing, it includes health care, it includes employment, it includes transportation. So college is one part of what we focus on, but obviously for youth who are headed in that direction, it becomes a very big part of what we focus on. Last year in Lane County, we had 18 youth who enrolled in Lane Community College out of the 80 that were part of our program. We also had 3 enroll at the U of O as freshmen. So a pretty good percentage of our students want to go to college, and they do transfer directly from graduating high school and enrolling that next fall, which is impressive. The greater problem that we see actually is retention once they start in college, and that has to do with a lot of different barriers. I just want to run through this list really quickly as sort of the top barriers that we've identified for our students. One of them is the lack of info that students are provided about college and about resources for them in a timely manner in high school. So we get students who are juniors and seniors in high school, and they're telling us that they would like to go to the university, and they're probably academically ready to go to the university, and yet because they didn't have the information in their freshman and sophomore years to know which classes to take and to know how to set themselves up to have a resume that will get them into college, we have to break the news to them that it's likely that they're not going to qualify for admission and that they're going to need to start at the community college level. That relates directly to the next barrier, which is a basic lack of academic preparation. This has been talked about a little bit today, but many of our youth are graduating from alternative schools. They're graduating with GEDs. They've experienced a lot of high school change. I actually had a young woman last year as a junior, went to 4 different high schools in one school year. And so when they graduate, even if they're motivated enough to go to community college, they are starting either in credit courses that are too low to qualify for a degree or actually in adult basic education programs at the community college. Obviously, housing has been touched on. I think Pamela did a great job of that. The community colleges obviously don't have dorms, so our youth are living in apartments, and that's a difficult adjustment to make. But even if they're lucky enough to go to a university that has dorms, that summer after their senior year is rough. Christmas break is rough. Spring break can be rough. So that's a huge barrier as well. Healthcare, I think, has been touched on well enough as it is. And then there is a category that I like to call college bureaucracy. And a lot of things fall under this category, but it basically is everything from the admissions process through the financial aid process, through enrolling in classes, through figuring out how to navigate when your online web account tells you some bizarre note that you don't know what it means that amounts to you've lost your aid for the next semester. And that, I think, really is can't be underestimated in terms of the barrier that it presents to students who are trying to get themselves through college. And in Lane County, we've taken several approaches to trying to tackle that sort of piece of the puzzle for our youth. So we've been working more closely in this last year with both Lane Community College and the U of O. We're lucky enough to have both institutions in our backyard. At LCC, we worked with the Enrollment and Financial Aid Department, and they did designate a liaison for us, who is now our go-to person whenever youth and ILP are having problems with either of those two categories. She has been a lifesaver a number of times, most especially in the week before term starts, when the wait is 3 hours long to talk to an enrollment person, and we have Fiora's direct line that we can call and get access to our kids to her help. We also work with Academic Learning Services at LCC, and they gave us essentially office space to use in the tutoring center so that twice a week, one or two of us from ILP can be out on the campus for a set number of hours, say from noon to 3, and our kids know that we're there, and they know that they can come access help. So obviously we don't work for the college, but we have some resources in terms of helping them navigate that bureaucracy. So if a student shows up at our office hours out at LCC and says, look, I was told this morning when I tried to register online that my account was blocked and I couldn't register, we can literally walk them to the correct office and help them walk through that process. So it gives us a little bit easier access to our clients and to the personnel at the college. We also are just starting a new program in ILP with the help of United Way in Lane County and Women in Philanthropy that targets 10 of our young women in high school who are college-bound. And there are many components to that program that I can go into more if you want to hear about them. But among other things, the college is now in talks with Women in Philanthropy to provide additional scholarships to the women in that program who end up going to Lane Community College. So we've had outstanding luck working with LCC. It however, is just the beginning, and we obviously have much more work to do because among those 18 youth who started at LCC this fall, even with those supports in place, we had two who were forced to drop out sometime during the first term, and at the end of the first term, over half of our youth were either on academic probation or suspension of their financial aid for not meeting minimum GPA requirements and not passing a minimum percentage of their credits. So even with that basic level of support that we were able to put together with the college, obviously our youth are still struggling with a lot of different things. With the University of Oregon, we actually were approached by the university financial aid office. One of their officers had been to a national training that talked about a Casey Family Foundation model for helping students succeed in college, and he approached us very excited about that idea and what he had learned. So his goal, based on the Casey model, was to put together a committee of people at the university, one member from every office significant to the life of youth, to try to address how we could better serve foster youth. So they invited ILP to do trainings for the admissions office, the financial aid office, student services, and we haven't done it yet, but housing as well, in the hopes that one member of each of those departments will agree to be on a working group that we can help students overcome the barriers presented by each of those departments. In addition, the university started a new program this year called Pathways Oregon. It's targeted at low-income youth who qualify for the Pell Grant, essentially. And that program provides not only additional tuition support for the youth, but it also provides additional academic counselors and, similar to what Pamela was talking about, sort of a tracking program for the youth, just to keep tabs on them, to make sure they have the information that they need, and to have somebody there to reach out to them if suddenly the student kind of drops off the radar, which is, I think, a very important part of helping these youth succeed in college. So that's what we started to do in Lane County through ILP. Obviously, there's a lot more that we would like to do. We have not addressed the need to reach out to younger high school students and to get more information out to high schools and high school guidance counselors so that we can try to reach those youth at an earlier time. We would love to see an official person at the college, just as has been talked about earlier today, a person at the college designated with the responsibility to make those outreach efforts to youth in foster care. We would love to see ILP services extended to 24 if youth are in college. Right now, we can work with youth up to their 21st birthday, but the day they turn 21, we have no way to try to extend that if we feel like they still need help. I would actually ditto that recommendation for Oregon Health Plan. I love the idea of extending it up to 21, but how much better would it be if we could extend it up to 24 if youth were still in college, which is pretty much the standard for private health insurance companies. I think I had a young woman actually on my caseload, one of the students who started at the U of O, who is a Ford Scholar. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Ford Family Program, but they have a brilliant scholarship program worked out that includes a summer conference, basically, for all of the youth in the program, and it begins the summer before they start college, and it continues every summer until the summer after they've graduated. And I think that would be a really nice model to talk about a summer academy of some kind for youth aging out of foster care who are headed into college, to help give them more of that information about what resources they do need to tackle college, how to navigate the bureaucracy, even such basic things as study skills, because if they have graduated high school with a GED, they may not be used to the system of needing to set aside the time to study and keeping up with homework on the college level. I think the idea of educational mentors is a fantastic one, whether that happens via email or in person. I think that's incredibly important. And also some way to reach out to former foster youth who are coming back to college at a later age. Because like I said, ILP goes up now only to 21. And so we don't have a way to get a lot of this information to alums who are 25, 28, 30 and deciding that they want to come back to college for the first time. I guess that's about my summary for today, but I would love to answer questions if anybody has them.
Thank you. Are there questions? Representative Roblin.
Yeah, thank you both for being here, and I am truly impressed with both of the testimony, and your life stories were impressive to me as a high school principal and having worked with a number of kids. And do we have an idea of how many kids are seniors annually in Oregon in the foster program? Do either of you know that?
I don't know the Oregon numbers. I think in Lane County we average about 30.
30 kids a year?
That are seniors.
That are seniors.
Yeah.
Okay.
Statewide.
Yeah.
In 2008, 387 foster youth aged out of care. That's current data.
Okay. Because I think it is important for us to keep in perspective the numbers here. Because they aren't overwhelming, but in each case, it's an overwhelming story. I think that's the part that is hard to people to understand. And I thought you did an exceptional job of setting the tone for what those things are. In your work in your program, do you do a survey at the end from the students that have taken advantage of it, to identify which were the most important aspects and which were what were the things that they wish that had been there that weren't from their perspective?
Unfortunately, we have not in the past. We actually are just working on a database system that will help us better track the youth in our program. And as part of the HOPE program that the United Way is helping us with the 10 girls specifically, part of that grant funding is also for data collection. So we're hoping in the next year or two to have much better figures about that, but we have not in the past.
Hold up. Mm-hmm. The one thing I would really encourage you to do, because I think we found out things about our school when we interviewed the people, especially and things like the 9 kids at Lane who weren't being successful. What was the impediment to that? So that, because I think sometimes we were shocked at the school, we would find some pretty common themes. You know, it wasn't that each one of them was different. Now, there were some things that are just very different. Other things happen, and it's a myriad of things. But there oftentimes are those, wow, why didn't we think of this before?
Absolutely.
And that's why the testimony today was really exceptional with the two of you together, because I think when people have personal experiences, it really does resonate a little easier to try to figure out, and it's easy to make the connection with your own kids, having had 3 go through school and filling out FAFSA forms and then realizing that every year they called me. I mean, it was their FAFSA form. But they knew that I had it in a place, so I could get it, and they were moving all over the place. So, and they didn't always know where to look for theirs. So I relate to that a lot, and I thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just following up on Representative Roblin, you know, those 387 students, in many ways they face similar challenges, and in many ways, each one is very much an individual. And I think, you know, one danger that we can fall into is stereotyping foster youth. I myself have had the pleasure of teaching writing at the community college level for many years. And, you know, one of the blessings of that is I get inside the experiences of a lot of people. Last year, I had a writing assignment asking people to write about a family ritual, right? Family in the larger sense, not necessarily immediate. And I had one woman wrote about, you know, for her family ritual was having a foster situation end and moving on to the next one, because she had been in just an enormous number of them. And it was really interesting, because this was a woman who was in her late 20s, very well-dressed. She always came to class very well-dressed. A lot of the younger students looked up to her, and I talked with her and asked her if she minded my, you know, sharing her story with the class as a whole. She did not. In fact, she encouraged me, and you know, it turned out that there were several other students in the class who were also had a foster youth background, And in fact, there was one woman who was whose children were in family foster youth at the time. She was in recovery and was kind of struggling, actually, to get her kids back. They ended up getting together and forming, a bond. There were a lot of differences among them. You know, one of them had been like this woman kind of bounced from family to family, or that's how she saw it. Others had been in much more stable, where they were with relatives, in foster care with relatives. They had very different experiences, and yet in many ways they had similar experiences. And so I guess that leads me to suggest three lessons. One is that we not stereotype foster youth. Second, that any college which is looking at enhancing its support services really look at peer support services, because the peers can often be really the strongest advocates. And then the third thing is to also think about the parents whose children are in foster care, who may be in college as well. In this woman's case, she herself had been in foster care, and now her children were in foster care, and that was very, very hard for her because she had always assumed that she would get out of that cycle and had not been able to. I'd like to suggest that there be a place for people in that situation as well.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Representative Chair Gelser. I'd like to follow up on what Representative Dembrow said, because in hearing Emily's comments about foster children not learning about education, possibilities for education their freshman or sophomore year, it really brought back to me, as a former Head Start director, the impediments for success in school oftentimes are how schools receive them. And in our particular program, we had 8 different school districts, and I can tell you each school district was different. And so I wondered if that was an issue for you, that some school districts might be more understanding of foster children than others.
I would say more than school district, it even varies by school. And there are some schools that are obviously more college-oriented than others. There are some schools that are smaller and the counselors are able to give youth more personalized attention versus schools where youth kind of are lost in the shuffle fairly immediately. But yes, school transfer is a very traumatic event for kids, not just because of the emotional connections that they lose, but also because of the paperwork shuffle that happens and the credits that they lose, the information that they lose, the connection with career and college centers that they lose. And that does vary widely by school and by school district.
Thank you.
Any further? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, and it's not necessarily for these very articulate young women, but the differentiation of the terms foster care or a homeless student, I think there's a difference, but I don't know what it is. And because when we're talking about how many foster children there are that are graduating, I don't think that encompasses homeless. Well, my colleague might know the answer.
Representative Roblin.
My understanding that this would be a subset of homeless. They aren't considering having their own home as foster care, so they would meet their criteria. But there's a lot of people who live in hotels and tents and other that are also considered homeless. So homeless population is bigger than the foster care population.
That's what I thought.
And I thought they were considered. I thought when I was going through that we counted foster care people as being. I'll have to go back to that one.
Why don't they
were part of the homeless.
Well, maybe they do
criteria.
Have the answer.
Maybe our panelists have the official answer for us.
I am not by any means an expert on homeless youth, but I don't believe that foster youth are considered homeless youth for those.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is that the FAFSA this year actually has made a change. And I don't know if somebody wants to talk. Okay. But the FAFSA has made a change so that now the ward of court is one checkbox that will qualify youth as independent, and there are a different series of qualifications for youth that have been designated homeless.
And can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Certainly.
Thank you.
And I'll just kneel instead of trying to pull the chairs. We have all connected. Kevin George, I foster care manager for the Department of Human Services. Specifically, Representative Roblin, you're correct. It's really the McKinney-Vento Act that actually defines homeless individual, homeless youth. And in some school districts, they all-inclusive identify foster children as being part of that, so they would be a subset of their overall reporting. Other school districts are not necessarily including that, and so there's this push-pull going on right now. Our foster children, which they meet the federal definition because they're temporarily in a temporary situation, and not all school districts do that, but for the most part, they're a subset, as you were saying.
So could I follow up on that? To me, the difference that jumps out to me between a homeless youth and a youth in foster care, while both would experience significant challenges, what would be unique about the foster youth is the lack of permanency and stability of that human home that wraps around that young person as they go through life, where that physical structure that you live in is very important for your health and well-being. That might change over time, but the people that wrap around a child, not having those people be the same over time, creates a really unique challenge that would be very different from the challenges of, am I correct?
Chair Gelsler, certainly from my perspective, again, Pamela may have a different one because she's gone through it, but it is about kind of going to Representative Maurer's question about what is permanency and having that permanent community, permanent group of people that are there to support you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, regardless of what setting you're in, is really the key in permanency. And many of our foster youth who may or may not have a family as they leave the system may have a family that is defined by teachers, CASAs, caseworkers, other foster parents, all kinds of folks. That may be constitute who their family is, but it really goes to who they see as permanent and who is their permanent connections. Who are they going to call when they need the $20? Who are they going to call when they need to, I use the example this morning for some of you, who are they going to put down on an emergency contact sheet when they have to fill out a job application? Who do you put down there? That's your permanent connections.
Okay.
Could I follow up?
Yeah, Service Center Comp.
And just to clarify, a lot of the students that I've worked with in the past I have worked with some foster children, but absolutely homeless, that they do not live with family. Mm-hmm. They live from couch to couch to couch. And so there's a whole other category of students, children, youth out there that try to face these every day from sometimes a very young age all the way through. So it there's just so many layers and levels of need.
Thank you, Representative Comp. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gelsler. In terms of what you're talking about in homeless foster care, somehow for me the funding comes into play. And the foster child would be funded by the state.
Right.
Homeless may not necessarily be funded by anybody.
That's right.
And so what Representative Comp is describing is a child who hasn't even been identified by any sort of system.
And again, I will reiterate that this is out of my area of expertise in terms of homeless youth, but I have come in contact with a number of youth who are friends of my clients who are experiencing homelessness, and so that's the little bit that I know of. And in the past, there's not been much that we could help them with in terms of college and financial aid specifically, because they were not, for FAFSA purposes or for federal aid purposes, considered independent students. And so they still were theoretically being supported by parents and would need to provide parental information on their FAFSAs and for college, where a lot of us know that youth who are homeless cannot actually rely on their families for that type of support. So the FAFSA has changed this year. In addition, for the qualifications that will make a student automatically independent for purposes of financial aid, there used to be five or six of them, and there were several new ones added this year. And I believe that if a youth has been qualified as homeless by a McKinney-Vento school district liaison or by the director of a federally funded homeless shelter, that they now also will be considered independent for financial aid purposes.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to say, and that has been, they've been working on that for a while, because there have been kids in schools that the parents have a family history that at 18 you move out, and you turn 18 halfway through your senior year. And we find out that they have just been moved out. And so even though they still have family and all that kind of stuff, sometimes they do the same thing that you did. They found their own foster family with a friend's house and so on and so forth. And they had a really difficult time in the past. It's becoming easier for them to qualify now automatically to become right. independent. And it did take a while before.
The other exciting change on the FAFSA this year is that the language now reads, if you were a ward of the court any time after, I believe, your 13th birthday. And it used to be if you were a ward, if you were currently or were at the age of 18 a ward of the court, that you qualified as independent. We experienced a lot of youth who had left foster care prior to their 18th birthday for any number of different reasons and therefore could not check that box on their FAFSA. And they will be able to starting this year. So that's a nice change as well.
Thank you both very much for your very informative and eloquent testimony. Next, we have Danielle Hillard and Maddie Brown.
Just going to close for support, ma'am, if you don't mind.
And the chairs unhook if you want to come. I've heard rumored that the chairs unhook.
They do.
Is it a trick?
Oh, it's a test.
Here we go.
A skill-based test.
Yeah.
So, welcome. And if you just speak your name into the microphone, you don't have to get really close to the microphone, but that way we know who you are forever.
Okay, I'm Maddie Brown, and I've been in foster care since the age of, I think I was 13, and I actually put myself into foster care. I grew up with just my mom, and she was a drug addict, and my brothers were kind of the same, into drugs, didn't go to school, none of them graduated. I'm actually the first one in my family to graduate from high school.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I just decided that I don't have to live like that. So I put myself into foster care, and I was in, since the age of 13 to 18, I was in 3 different foster homes. I went to 2 different middle schools and 3 different high schools. And I went from being an honor student to graduating with a 2.36 GPA because my credits did not follow me. Mm-hmm. So instead of my goals for going to Oregon State, I am going to LBCC and I will transfer there. But I wasn't able to go to the university because I wasn't able to keep my grade point average up. And when I started to go to LB, the family that I ended up with was my best friend all through grade school. It was her family that actually took me in, and that was my last foster home. And they didn't go to college themselves. They didn't really know how to fill out the FAFSA. I kind of figured it out on my own, trial and error. And because I didn't really know who to ask. You know, a lot of the financial aid advisors, they don't know a lot about, you know, go here, this person will help you fill out this, go here, this person, you know, can help you here. So it was kind of trial and error, and I ended up actually having to spend like $1,500 on my own before I finally started getting aid, because I didn't know what to do, what deadlines to meet. I didn't know who to go to. So I definitely think having someone on campus would help so much, like just knowing that this person you can go to, you know, at any time during the week, knowing they can help you fill out that form, you know, tell you this scholarship is available to you, or go ahead and apply for this grant, or anything like that. That kind of just support is really, really great. And some of the people earlier were talking about healthcare. I know that, you know, people going, like, I went into foster care later on in life, but the problems that I had prior to going into foster care, like, you know, with my mom, with my family, a lot of kids don't, you know, they don't go to counseling or anything like that, or they're not ready to talk because they don't really, they don't know who to trust. They don't know, okay, I know you well enough to talk to you about this. This is what I went through, and I'd like to talk to you about it. I've tried to get counseling and stuff. I had OHP up until 18, but then you get dropped off, you know, soon after. I think that opening up counseling also, in addition to people at the college that you can talk to, I think would be a really big help. Just someone that you can talk to, because a lot of people aren't ready to talk until later on. And that's through DHS. I've called DHS at least. That's all I knew to call. And it's not available to prior foster care kids, but people in foster care it's available to. So having that, would be really great too. That's all.
And what are you studying?
I'm going to school for nursing. I want to be a pediatric nurse.
Fantastic. Well, congratulations for taking charge of your life and making a lot of really good decisions.
Thanks.
Let's move forward. Are there questions?
That's a pretty gutsy move.
It is.
It really is. Yep.
It is.
He's also a Chafee Grant recipient.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, thank you for coming today to share your story. And please.
Hi, my name is Danielle Hilliard. I've been in foster care for 4 years. And I lived with my mom until I was 15, and then I got taken away. I got put in a group home in Ashland, and then I got kicked out of there because I didn't get along with anyone that lived there. They just all picked on me and didn't like me, so I got kicked out of there, and then I had to live in a detention center for criminals. And I didn't do anything wrong. I just got put there because I didn't know where else to go. And then I went to a foster home for a year. So they couldn't take me longer than 6 months, but they kept me for 6 more months because I didn't have anywhere else to go. And then I went to a foster home in Bonanza, Oregon. And then they were really rude and mean to me, and they treated me like crap. So then my probation officer, she took me out of there, and I went to the farm home. And I graduated from there, and I went to a foster home in Salem. And they were not very nice either, so I went to the detention center again, and then I went to another foster home for about 6 or 7 months, and then I got put in a group home, and then the group home kicked me out, they put me in an apartment, and then I got evicted from there. I didn't have anywhere to go, so I had to live in a hotel, and no one would help me, and then I found my own apartment, and now I live there.
College program.
I'm doing my GED at LBCC.
Exciting. Congratulations. Are you living alone in your apartment, or do you have a roommate?
I live with my boyfriend.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming to share your story today. What kinds of supports do you need? What would make it easier for you to be able to complete your GED?
A program that talks about what steps you need to take to get into the college, because I'm going to get my GED after I get $25 so I can take the test.
Mm-hmm.
Because I already studied everything, and I did the pretest, and I passed them all. And the teachers want me to take the test, but I don't have $25.
Are there any resource programs for... Are there scholarship programs for the GED?
Scholarship, but the foster don't get in that loop, so they don't know
about GED.
And we go back to our other misinformation or no information area for that. So now that I know, I can connect her to that service.
All the foster homes I was ever in, they never told me that I could ever go to college or anything like that. I had to go to like 8 different schools, and I was moved, and I was doing this program on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
I had to get, it's called SK Online. I lived in Salem most of the time. And I had to get 2 more of those credits online. I could have got my high school diploma online. But then I had to move from a different city, and I didn't get to finish it.
Well, I'm so glad that you're at LBCC and that you're going to finish that degree. When you enroll at LBCC, what do you want to study?
I'm not sure yet.
Okay. Are there other questions? No. Thank you both very much for coming and sharing your stories. Certainly we have a lot to learn, so we can do better by students and folks to keep you in more permanent places as you're coming through. So thank you very much for stepping up. Next, Frank Warren and Angela Ritt.
Hi, I'm Frank Warren. I started college just recently, about a year ago. I started college, and like I said, I'm 32. I think I said that. A little bit nervous. Excuse me. But I've kind of been in the loop with foster homes and stuff since the age of 4. I was adopted at the age of 5. My brother and sister and I were taken out of a home that my mother was borderline mentally retarded. My dad was really bad into drugs. And so we were taken out of that situation. And later I was adopted at the age of 5 and then till I was about 15. And then I got put back into the foster care system. So, but I've been through a lot of different foster homes, group homes, juvenile detentions. I was a pretty troubled kid. I did a lot of, anything I could to get in trouble when I was a kid. I didn't really have a lot of goals. I didn't really have anything, my mind set on anything. I can't really say that I really heard. I went through the independent living program. I went through a lot of the different programs that they offered from the state. I ended up by living. CSD gave me money at the age of 18 to where I could live on my own and do things like that. But during that period of time, and I know that things have changed. We've heard some of the things that have changed, but they didn't really talk about college. We took classes like on modeling and different things like that, and I never really heard anything about college. And so at that point in my life, that wasn't really a goal. I ended up by getting a job, and later in life, until about 5 years ago, I was just really into a lot of trouble, doing a lot of stupid things. I ended up by doing drugs and whatnot, but kind of gotten straightened out now, and it's been kind of one of those things. I've had some good people in my life that have really pushed me forward and have really helped me and been a backbone for me, and I've had to do a lot of this work on my own, trying to find things about the college and whatnot. For the FAFSA, I have a lovely wife that helped me with that, and just people in my life in those areas. But one of the things, it just seems like a lot of, this experience for me getting into college back then, as I look at things now, and I still work with foster kids, and I work with foster parents in my life. I still have good contact with ex-foster parents, and one of them did actually, like in my 20s, she did try to kind of help me. She financed me to get into a little bit, a couple college programs. Anyways, I just, some of the walls that I've hit were with financial aid and whatnot. And I guess that's about it, really.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Tell them a program you're in.
I'm getting a certificate in graphic design and web design.
Wonderful.
And hopefully get into OSU here soon too. So
congratulations.
Thank you.
And go Beavers.
Yeah.
I heard that.
Angela.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you doing?
Good. I'm a little nervous. I wrote everything down, so sorry if it sounds like hi, my name is Angela. I'm 22, and I go to LBCC, and this is my story. I was born in Schwäbisch-Gmünd, Germany, and put into care at age 2 due to my mother's great interest in drugs and lack of interest in caring for a child at a young age. My stepfather and grandfather got me out of the system. Then mom, stepdad, and I came to the U.S. There we had lived together for a few years. Within that time, we moved around a lot. Mom and stepdad divorced. Mom was still interested in drugs, and she had different male figures around a lot that came and went and weren't very kind. At age 6, I had a brother that was... Sorry, he's like 4 years younger than me. And I was mothering him because my mom couldn't do it. And I was also caring for myself. I love my mother, but I hated who she was and the choices she made. I knew I did not want to live with her. One day at school, a counselor approached me and started to ask me questions about my home situation due to bruises that occurred on skin that showed. Shortly after that, I was put back into the system with my brother. We stayed with an older couple, and they decided that for me as an 8-year-old, they didn't want me because I was too old and they wanted to care for toddlers. But I'm sure that it was because I was so troubled. After a month or so, we were placed with a woman that I'd known, that had known my mom and stepdad, and so she wanted to care for us. So we went into the care of a middle-aged widowed lady that somewhat knew. Sorry, I keep messing up. I'm sorry. That was somewhat new, and her name was Leela. In the beginning, I realized it was hard for her to care for an eight-year-old that has only seen and been there through disturbing situations in her life, and a little boy that had his dad's temper and was always troubled. But with enough faith and love and help from child psychologists or therapists, we slowly started to see a beautiful breakthrough. In the 10 years I lived with her, I gained so much knowledge, and I learned about God, manners, how to forgive, how to love and know that I can be loved back. And basically, I went from a troubled, disturbing little girl to a young woman. Throughout high school, I gained a great caseworker, which shared with me about different programs the state had to offer to foster children, such as subsidy and the Chafee Scholarship. My senior year, I moved out on my own with the help of ILP and subsidy, and I became independent. Throughout senior year, my counselor helped me apply for college and financial aid and helped me learn and apply for the Chafee Scholarship. But it would have been nice to know about Foster Specific Opportunities College. Now in college, I'm in my third year finishing up my AOT, and I plan to transfer to OSU. I've been very, very grateful and have been getting help from Chafee. And to be able to go to college, it gives me the thought that someone does care and does want me to succeed. I've been really blessed on becoming the person I am today with the help of many, and I'm so grateful. For further college success as a foster youth, I think it would be wonderful and very important to have a designated person in a college to help me and other foster children or former ones to figure out the college process and programs, and just to be there to let us know that they're there for us whenever we need someone to talk to or when we have problems with whatever. They're there to help, and they have a great understanding of what we've been through and can help us greater our chances to success. So I think it'd be great.
Thank you. You did great. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions for Angela? Representative Parker.
Not really questions, and not really just for you, Angela, but mm-hmm. for everyone who's been out here. I'm 54 and former professor. I hate that FAFSA form.
I just filled it out again yesterday, and I hope to God it was the last time.
And second, for all of you, I am... so happy that you all came here today. I am both dismayed and inspired. I've been quiet as I've listened to all of you. I'm dismayed by the situation as it exists right now, but really inspired by the stories that you're all telling and the perseverance you have. And we're looking at a very difficult situation moving forward here financially. And I tend to think that we have limited resources. We have very limited finances. Very, very severely limited finances that we're looking at. But the resourcefulness that you folks have shown truly is inspirational. So thank you for coming, telling us your tales, giving us your thoughts for how to move forward, and that even a box of cookies shipped cross-country is a fantastic help. So I think there's a lot we can do and to help make happen from this position, even in spite of our financial woes.
Thank you, Representative Parker. Representative Roblin, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I wanted to say the same thing. It's been impressive to hear from people, and I have had the opportunity to talk to a lot of kids over the years in my previous jobs, but I guess the statement I wanted to make that was made here by Angela the most was the and it was also made earlier, the idea of counseling and the need for it. If there was one thing, and it sounded true in your case too, many of these students, by the time they get to foster care, have already been independent human beings. Mm-hmm. They shouldn't have been independent human beings at 12, 10, for whatever they became independent. But for a number of years, they were managing their lives because no one else in their family was managing it, so they had taken over. And they get put into these foster care situations where most of those foster cares had their own kids that they raised all along, but they never raised an independent human being who still looked like they were a child. Because it's a very different thing. And I think what you're saying about having the opportunity to stay with one family for long enough where the counseling was where they weren't going to give up on you, we were going to make it, can't be overstated as I hear these different stories, because you have to realize that there are people that are going to take care of you. You don't have to always keep on the lookout for how am I going to take care of myself tomorrow, because today there's somebody there. And I watched that over and over again with kids in foster care, with some of the best people and really great kids, but the tension that took place in those first little whiles was just so amazing and heartbreaking to watch. So I hope that we can continue to talk about the need for counseling, and the counseling that when it's available at the time people need it, not just at the time when we think we should give it to them. So thank you for the testimony.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I can't echo enough just what my colleagues have said in their appreciation of your coming. And I'm wondering, just how did you all find each other? And is there some kind of, you know, mutual support kind of network there at LBCC?
We're working on that. What we did was we have an advisory group that actually tells us what we should be doing. We put an out call for these individuals just because.
Bill, can you come closer to the microphone and introduce yourself again?
I'm sorry, Bill Tallman, Vice President of Student Services and Government Relations at Lynn Benton Community College. And what we've done is, because you have Frank Story, who's 32, and I will address Representative Dimbrough and Representative Roblin, that there is 387 out of seniors in high school, but there's thousands that are at the community colleges, as you will. Now, they're coming back the other way. So that story was a little different. It's where Danielle was as a GED coming out. It's a 19-year-old who's lived in 10 places. So what we're trying to do is establish a network that actually gives them a chance to talk to each other, because no other students know what they've been through and can't talk about it. Mm-hmm. And at this point, the self-disclosure, they can't talk to anybody because they don't know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So that's the network we're trying to put out there and do some Facebook and do some things with that. They can find each other and become more of a peer group and kind of some things. You heard Frank works with other foster youth, that we can probably network that forward and backwards. So that's where we're at LBCC. We'd hope to do that statewide with all the institutions and with some of the people that we have in the room today.
Well, that sounds great, and I really appreciate what you're doing.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Any further questions, comments? Representative Cobb.
I can't resist, but I believe that anybody that's either homeless or a foster student, after they finish the financial aid thing, they ought to earn at least one college credit. And I'm serious. If you can figure that puppy out, you've earned a college credit.
Graduates.
I have to put in my plug, and that is make sure that every high school in the state has Aspire volunteers who actually walk you through the process, and it isn't nearly as bad. And if you keep everything you did the first time, it's much easier the second time and the third. But I appreciate the commission being here, but Aspire opened my eyes to the way in which things can be done and how you can get volunteers to help a lot of students. And I will tell you that some of that permanency that we talked about before, I know that some of the volunteers that we had in Aspire have become the permanency people for some of our kids. And it has continued for many, many years thereafter. And I actually get invited every once in a while when I'm at home to go to lunch with some of those kids that are coming back, because their Aspire volunteer calls me and says, so-and-so's going to be back in town, and you need to be down here to say hi. So, I mean, it is amazing how one person in the lives of other people can make a difference, and Aspire is one of those programs that I believe every school should have. So,
thank you. Well, thank you, all of you, for coming today. Thanks to Lynn Benton Community College for the topic idea to bring forward. This is clearly an area in which we have a lot more work to do to meet our obligation to kids. I'm so impressed with each of you that have come and shared your story all the way from beginning the process to get a GED to working for Children First for Oregon, which I think you will provide a tremendous service to young people all across the state, and all of you in coming today to share your stories, which I know is hard in a public place in a formal setting. So thank you all so very much. And with that, we will close the public hearing, or the informational hearing. and open a work session for the introduction of committee bills.
Madam Chair, I actually have a question first.
Yes.
Is there an opportunity that we're going to have a public hearing on these at all?
Explain the
process, if you would, please.
On the hearing we just had or on the bills?
On the bills possibly introducing.
So, again, on the introduction of bills, that just puts them in the spigot, and then if the speaker assigns them to our committee, we would put them in the process to calendar them for a public hearing, and then depending on the hearing goes, possibly for a work session.
Okay.
But, again, it's a formality to introduce them, and voting in favor of introducing a bill does not commit anyone's vote towards the actual content of the bill or suggest that they will vote for the bill when it comes up for a public hearing, a work session, or to the House floor.
Okay. Very good. Great. Madam Chair, I would move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 2836, dated 13009, and LC 2396. Dated 12909.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing no objection, they are introduced. Oh, that's why you gave me a script.
Is there further objection? Okay. If not, the measures are introduced as committee bills.
Thank you. The work session on introduction of committee bills, with the hope that I'll learn how to do that better next time. So,
you will.
Thank you all very much, and we are adjourned.
I think it is good.